Hello, everyone. Welcome back. You just tuned in to Set for Success with Richard Lannan, and you knew that already, didn't you? Because you listened to the intro. What are we going to do? We're going to continue our journey to help you create a roadmap to change your business, your career, and life. And how are we going to do that? Through chatting with one person at a time to uncover people's lives, their business, their journey, their successes to help you create the success that you deserve. And you do deserve to be successful. I actually want you to say that right now, because what else do you say when you have a show called Set for Success? I deserve to be successful, whatever success is to you. Now, one of the things you know about me, is if you're listening in all the time, is that I love quotes, and I probably look at quotes daily, and I'm always looking for interesting ones. And today's quote is, "Those fields of daisies we landed on, the dusty fields, the desert stretches, the memories of many skies and earth beneath us, many days, many nights of stars." Now, that was written by and quoted by Anne Lindbergh. If you don't know who Anne Lindbergh is, she's an American author, aviator, and wife of Charles Lindbergh. She was an acclaimed author whose books and articles span genres from poetry to nonfiction, touching upon many topics from youth to age, love and marriage, peace and solitude and contentment, and the role of women in the 20th century. And now we're in the 21st century. Lindbergh's book, Gift of the Sea, is a popular inspirational book reflecting on the lives of American women. So if you're looking for something, maybe a little bit of reflection on American women, might be a book you want to check out. Some days I connect the dots and other days I don't. I feel that this is maybe one of those days. The dots are not quite connected. I sort of woke up that way. Have you ever had a day start that way? Think about it for a second. And what was your response to that question? On those days, I try to imagine what life would be just like if there was another place, another time, another person or business I could invest in to help be more successful. Whatever success is for them. Obviously, success is one of those things you have to define. I think you have to define it for yourself. For you, maybe it has something to do with getting out of the ordinary, out of your character. Something that no one else would ever think you might do. A unique day of long, something that you just want to do. Something that positively impacts and changes your life forever. What could that possibly be? What would be the thing that you might do in your life that would positively change and impact your life forever? When it comes to being set for success in your business, career, or life, it's actually not what you have that counts, but it's what you do with what you have that counts. This is a lesson I think I am still learning from clients, from peers, from family, from friends, from life overall. And I often get reminded daily of that in some way, shape, or form. And I hope you do too. It is way easy in business and life to get caught up in the perception of success, when really success is meant to be shared, used to make a difference. And that difference can be from anything, focused effort, to picking up trash in your neighborhood, whatever it takes. So I was thinking about the show today, and I was giving it some thought. I wondered who could share their business, their life journey with us. Someone who, in all appearances, did something strange, embraced something unique, that from the outsider looking in could even be considered a little nuts. And I'm sure that my guest liked that I said that today, and I can see them giggling on the other side right now. So I want you to close your eyes for a moment and imagine, just for a moment, that you took a plane, flew to the desert to pick up trash at the pyramids. Now add that spiritual journey and spend 40 days in the desert, which is what my guest did, and he called it The Embrace. Today I'm hanging out with Bruce Benson, world traveler, author, and creator of Flags of Humanity. Bruce, welcome to Set for Success today.
Thank you very much.
Bruce, you know, I'm excited to have you on. I had the opportunity to skim through your book and check out some of your things on the internet. But I always like to start the show off sort of like getting to personally get to know you a little bit. So why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Well, I'm...
Where do you start?
I'm 50. Yeah, I'm 57 years old. I have three children. I live in Gimli. I have, for the last 7 years, divided my time between Gimli and North Carolina, where my kids were going to school. But I've been a commercial fisherman on Lake Winnipeg for 30 years.
Okay.
30 plus years, and still am. I grew up in Gimli. I was very fortunate. I got sent to St. John's Cathedral Boys School in Selkirk when I was young, and that was very sort of pivotal as far as I'm concerned in my education. And both my parents were teachers. My father was the high school principal in Gimli, and my mother was a teacher as well.
Okay, so you had that academic influence right in your family home.
Yes, right from early on.
Yeah.
Yeah. I learned to read real good.
So much for the grammar, though.
Yeah, that's real spelled R-E-E-L.
Oh, there you go. I'm curious about fishermen. If you grew up in a family that was really teachers, academics, what led you into becoming a fisherman? What led you down that road?
Well, my father was a fisherman until he was 32, and he got tuberculosis. And they told him when he came out of the sanatorium that, what happens is they isolate you, and once your body forms what's called a tubercle around the infection, then you're not contagious anymore.
Okay.
And they let him out, and they told him that he did not have the lung capacity to be a commercial fisherman anymore, so he went into education.
Okay, so that was where the shift was. Okay, so that's your connection with your dad. So what led you into being a fisherman if your dad used to be a fisherman?
Yeah, it was strange because I was almost fascinated with it. Like, I grew up in Gimli. Fishermen were around me. I had compatriots, friends who were fishermen, but I knew nothing about it. So when I was 21, I got a job on a whitefish boat, which went north for about a month and a half, to catch whitefish. And since then, my brother moved back from Edmonton. He became a fisherman. And my father retired from teaching
and
fished commercially until he was 88 years old.
Wow. Wow.
So much for doctors saying you don't have the lung capacity to fish.
Yeah.
But so now my two brothers and I we still fish.
Okay. All right. Well, that's actually quite a good story.
Yeah.
I asked these questions because I was raised in Newfoundland. So
okay.
I grew up right on the water.
Big fishing, yeah.
Oh, yeah. And so, I mean, knowing fishermen, being on the water, I mean, I was just raised on the water. It's just the way it is, right? Even if you do spend a lot of time on land, you sort of get your sea legs early, so to speak. So I'm always curious when I meet people on the prairies, for example, and they say, well, I'm a commercial fisherman. You know, a lot of times for other people in Canada, that would never connect with them. They'd never be able to, what do you mean you're a fisherman? You live in Manitoba. Where's the water?
Oh, many times, Richard, I've talked to people and said, like, I'm a commercial fisherman from Canada. Oh, where do you fish? On the east or the west coast? Well, no, in the middle of the country. And they think that, where? On a lake?
Yeah.
And so, oh, then they think like, oh, that's like a girly boy stuff.
A little pond.
A little pond. I says, no, it's a big lake. And I tell you this, I fished commercially in Iceland. I fished commercially in Australia,
yeah,
on the west coast of Canada. And the closest I've ever come to death, by far, was on Lake Winnipeg.
That is a
treacherous body of water.
It is.
It absolutely is.
Okay.
And in the last 100 years, we've lost on average 2 fishermen per year.
Oh, wow. Well, so what is it makes that body of water treacherous? I got to get the word out.
It's so shallow.
Okay.
It's so shallow that the waves come at you. They hit you. When you're on the ocean, you go up the wave and
down the wave,
the wave. No. Here, you got a 20-foot boat, and bang, 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 you're hitting those waves. It is very, very... And in the book that we will be talking about at some point, I talk about the day that I came the closest to death.
And maybe that's what we'll do is we'll take a break, and when we come back, we'll talk about the day that you came closest to death. This is Richard Land for Set for Success, and we'll be right back. Hello and welcome back. I'm hanging out with Bruce Benson. Bruce, you know, just before the break, you gave me a perfect line in for a story. You were talking about being on Lake Winnipeg, and I know you've traveled the world. I want to talk about this, but you were talking about how you almost came closest to death out of all the places you've been in the world on Lake Winnipeg. Tell us about that story.
Well, I'll never forget it. I'm sure every fisherman on Lake Winnipeg has a story similar to it, but myself and my friend Ryan, my brother-in-law actually, we were pulling nets. It was October 30th. Would have been about 23, 24 years ago. And October 30th, the water gets pretty cold. It might
be
2 degrees.
Yeah.
And we were pulling nets, and the wind was blowing us offshore. We're about 5 miles out. The wind was blowing us offshore, and it was actually blowing us perfectly offshore. So we loaded up. We filled the boat with nets with the fish in them and put them into tubs. But there was more fish than we anticipated, so we ran out of tubs. So we threw the last of the fish and nets into the bow of the boat. And at the end, Ryan went back there and he said, lower the motor and let's get headed to shore. We started heading to shore, and he just kills the motor and says, Bruce, you better do this because I don't think I can. And I went back there and started driving. And normally I'd have to complained to Ryan to bail the boat out, because he didn't want to do it. No, not this time. He took one look at the waves coming in, and he was bailing, and he bailed. It probably took us about 2.5 hours to make that 5 miles into shore. Well, we were traveling at the speed of maybe a quarter of a mile an hour to begin with. Mm. And the waves were coming in, and every wave would put about 5 gallons of water into the boat.
So you're starting
hence the bailing.
Yeah.
And a gallon of water in my face. But I had to keep, and that's cold water, but I had to pay attention because every once in a while you get a rogue wave, a wave that is bigger than it should be. And I had to turn the bow of the boat just a little bit to avoid 100 gallons of water being put
coming
in there,
in one
which
shot.
Would have, and if we had sunk or filled up with water, we would have flipped and we'd have been dead.
Yeah.
And it took us about, like I said, about 2.5 hours to get in, and it was the closest I ever came to death.
Out of curiosity, how long was that? How long ago was that?
About 24 years ago. I wrote about it in the book that we will be talking about at some point, right, Richard?
I mean, the embrace.
Yeah,
yes. We've actually already started talking about the embrace, 40 days in the desert. Before that, I do want to talk about some of your journey in the 40 days in the desert. But I was reading up on you a little bit, and I got this impression that you're a bit of a world traveler, that before you did the 40 days in the desert, you actually visited a whole bunch of other places in the world. Like, tell us a little bit about that. I know that there's one story on your website about yourself and your son down in the Appalachian Mountains, and I guess it's sort of a coming-of-age story, I think.
Yeah, it was a coming-of-age. Like I said early on, I was very fortunate to go to St. John's Cathedral Boys School in Selkirk, and it was known as the toughest boys school in North America, but it was absolutely fantastic for me. So with my oldest boy, as a coming-of-age trip, the way I came up with it was a couple of my boys were talking to a friend of theirs, and they were Jewish. The friend was Jewish, right? And they were talking about his bar mitzvah. And,
which is a coming of age.
A coming of age trip, right?
Yeah.
A coming of age thing,
event,
right?
Yeah, celebration.
And I says, what does that mean? Oh, no, I didn't say. One of my sons asked his friend, what does that mean? It's when you become a man. And I thought about it, well, what do you need to do to achieve that? Just breathe long enough, eat and breathe long enough. So I thought, for my sons, I wanted them to have something, an epic trip of some sort. And what a better thing to do than do it with Dad. So with my oldest boy, we kayaked the Mississippi River.
Okay.
Now, I had kayaked it before, like I've done it twice, from the headwaters of in Lake Itasca down to New Orleans. So I'd already done it before, so I was...
You knew what you were doing.
I knew what I was doing. And it goes back to my St. John's experience that I have no problem. I can hop in a boat now and go paddle 2,000 miles. No problem. With the younger boy, Tiberius, quite the moniker.
Great name. Great name. I was looking at that.
Tiberius. With Tiberius, we were hiking the Appalachian Trail. Yeah. We did about 500 miles through the mountains in the Appalachian Trail. And one day, and I think this is where you're going with this, one day as he's stomping up the mountain, all mad at Dad for waking him up early, and he's stomping it, and he's a great stomper, just stomp, and muttering under his breath. And I'm behind him, and we're climbing up this mountain, and I'm just sort of chuckling to myself, not loudly to be disrespectful, but and I got to thinking, you know, because it was a coming of age trip, what kind of a world is he going to inherit? Mm. You know, if you think about it, and hiking is very conducive to thought.
Oh, very conducive.
You know, Mark Twain used to walk 15 miles every afternoon, you know, like it's very conducive to thought, fresh air and the exercise. And it's repetitive, so you're just walking, so the mind is free to wander. So I got to thinking, what kind of a world, it being a coming-of-age trip, what kind of a world is he going to inherit? Mm. If you think about it, the world's messed up in all kinds of ways. But if you think about it further, a little bit more, and again, hiking being conducive to thought, the world's messed up based on the differences between people, you know? But if you think about it, no matter a person's religion or lack thereof, no matter a person's skin color, nationality, or politics, these differences are as nothing compared to what we have in common. We are human.
Yes.
And so that night, I did a drawing in my journal of what I call the flag of humanity, something to celebrate the commonality of being human. And I think it has made its way. Slowly making its way around the world. It's been to Havana, it's been to Baghdad, it's been to Australia, it's been to, well, it's basically Philippines, Egypt. It's basically making its way around the world.
Yeah, and that's one of the organizations that I guess you started is the flagofhumanity.com, where you can actually check out a little bit more information on that. Yes?
Yeah, it's the flagofhumanity.com, is it?
Yeah. just helping you out there. It's very interesting that you took that time to do these journeys with your sons. So you and I actually hold that in common. I have two boys also, and there's 12 years between them. Married to the same person. I always tell this story about 12 years between them. But each one of them, when they got to that age where society said they're now a man, we went and did something individually, just father and son, for that journey. Because I often find that, and this is my side of this without going into details of what the stories would be, but I, in talking to other men, it surprised me about how many men do not take the time to do journeys with their sons to help them transition from boy, young man to manhood. This is Richard Land for Set for Success, and we will be right back. Everyone, welcome back. I'm hanging out with Bruce Benson. If you're just tuning in, Bruce and I were talking about the flags of humanity. We were also talking about the importance of transitioning your kids from what we'll call childhood to adulthood, whether maybe a son or a daughter, whatever that embrace. I don't want to just make it one side just for men bringing their sons to adulthood, but what about women bringing their daughters to adulthood? So, and maybe dads bringing their daughters to adulthood and vice versa. It's just part of the journey. I'm curious about your book and The Embrace is what it's called, 40 Days in the Desert. And so my very first question is going to be, why 40 Days in the Desert?
Well, there's certainly a biblical component to it.
Sure. And I actually, when I read that, I went onto the internet and went, okay, 40 Days in the Desert. I knew the biblical component, but I wanted to see what would show up, right? And just obviously tons of stuff. Go ahead.
Right. So, I guess I have to go back a little bit on
this. Yeah. Let's go back. Set it up.
My spiritual philosophy, I call the embrace, and it's sort of a commonality to all religions. You can just narrow it down to the golden rule, whatever. You can be whatever religion you want and still believe in the embrace. I was looking for some kind of an umbrella. You look at particularly between the Abrahamic religions, there seems to be a little bit of conflict going on in the world, right? And so I thought, I wanted to do something. Well, I'm not powerful. I can't do anything that way. I'm not rich. I can't do anything that way. But you know what I can do is I can pick up trash.
Yeah.
I can pick up garbage, and I can contribute in that way. And if you think about it, has the world ever needed trash men before as much as now?
Pretty much it does, actually. Yep.
So I chose Egypt because they call it the cradle of civilization, and it's the oldest sort of recorded human history is Egypt, and the pyramids was a natural. And so I remember my first day there, as I was flying over, I was constantly vacillating between hope and despair, if you will, because am I the stupidest son of a gun on earth doing this, flying halfway around the world to pick up trash at the pyramids? And some people said people will laugh at you and mock you and this.
Yeah,
and you're an idiot. Dude.
Yeah, you're an idiot. Yeah, you're nuts, which is why I start up my monologue.
Right.
Yeah.
Crazy.
I meant that.
I'm not crazy. And the response was so huge. It was unbelievable, the response of the Egyptian people and tourists walking by, seeing me pick up trash. They were saying, oh, my God. And they'd start picking up trash themselves. The children would be around me, the Egyptian children would be picking up trash and helping me. It was just
Now you did that as sort of alone by yourself, right? It's not like you created a team or anything, went over there. This was something that you did by yourself.
Yes, for some reason I felt driven to do it, you know. And I actually I told my son one time, we're in a pub in North Carolina, he was having iced tea and I was having a beer, and I told him, you know Ty, I really didn't and this may be a little bit difficult to believe, but I told him, you know, Ty, I really didn't expect to survive going to Egypt, you know, because somebody who is trying to promote the commonality of religions in the Middle East may not be well received.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
And so Ty said to me, he says, so you would have left us fatherless. And I didn't know how to respond to that.
Well, no, it's a bit heavy
but,
question.
But I know what I thought. My thought was, yes. So your children won't be. That was my thought.
Yeah,
I didn't have the courage to say it.
Yeah.
because, I mean, it sounds crazy. And now, having been there, and I went back 2 months after the revolution, after Mubarak was ousted from power. Oh, it was totally different then. Before, when I went the first time, the Egyptians kept me away. They kept the journalists away from me and me away from the journalists. After the revolution, I was doing it again, and I got a great story about that one. Okay. Oh, Canada. Oh, that's great. When I went back, they took me to the journalists. I was doing radio interviews. I was on TV. I was in the press. Like, they were bringing me to the journalists.
Okay, so let's go to the original time you went. So because there's two stories here going on. So the original time you went, you just went to pick up trash. Okay,
yes.
And you did that over a 40-day period, I gather.
40 days.
40
yeah.
days. So now that brings me up to the original question, I think.
My
why 40 days?
Days?
I told you I'd go back to it.
Okay, yeah, you can bring things back, Richard. You're not so slow. I don't care what anybody says.
well, thanks, Bruce. I appreciate that.
No, but, yeah, well, 40 days because, like I said, I was raised in a Christian school, and I knew the and it just seemed perfect. 40 days in the desert.
Yeah.
I'm in the desert, in the Sahara Desert,
yeah.
And I'm picking up trash. And I always thought it had to be at least 40 days. 20 isn't enough. 30 isn't enough. 40, for some reason, I know when I did the Mississippi, each time it was about 67 days, and about 40 is where you're in it.
Yeah.
You've committed to 40 days. That's a long trip, a long time to do one thing. And so perhaps maybe that's why Jesus spent 40 days in the desert. I don't know why it had to be 40 days, but then, for me, I felt compelled to do 40 days.
Okay, I was curious about that because, I mean, I figured looking at it and originally reading up on you and stuff that, I mean, that was a decision that was made, right? And I figured there was a connection spiritually to that too. Now, you often talk in the book about different experiences you had because I can't imagine it was all good. Right. There must have been peaks, what I call peaks, valleys, and detours. Right. So really good times, really low times. And then suddenly you experience a detour that you never anticipated would happen. What are some of the maybe stories you can share with us that might be some peaks and valleys?
I remember when I guess, homegrown terrorists in Egypt blew up a bomb in El Khalili Market and killed a French woman about 20 years old or something like that. The next day, I was hauled in. Like they hauled me into an office, and they went through all my stuff, asked me all kinds of questions, and they were very good about it. But I could tell that the law was coming down because tourism is huge in Egypt, and you kill a French tourist, it's not good. But I found out later that Mohamed Chia, the director of operations for the Gizel Plateau, who became a good friend of mine in the course of my time there, he said that he was searched the day after that bomb went off.
Okay.
There is the director of the Gizel Plateau is searched. And here I'm a stupid Canadian picking up trash,
yeah.
You know. And I found out later also that, because I went the second time, as after everything was ransacked, I was picking up trash at the entrances to these locked areas, right, where tourists didn't go, weren't even allowed to go. They let me go wherever. After they followed me for about a week, and after that, they just let me go wherever I wanted to go.
Yeah, yeah.
And I found out later that I was picking up trash at the entrances to these places that had millions of dollars worth of antiquities in them. And I had no idea.
Mm.
You know, I had no idea at all. But they gave me free range after that, after the... and I still remember, I knew I was going to be all right when the guy who had... he's waiting for a phone call. And the phone call will determine what happens to me. And I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know what the options are. Will I be in prison? Will I... What? I don't know. Kicked out of the area, off the plateau. And then I heard his cell phone ring. And it was Bad to the Bone by George Thurgood. I was like, I think I'm going to be all right.
Yeah.
So.
Well, interesting stories,
yeah,
interesting
yeah, yeah.
times.
Well, I got a million of them.
You have a million of them.
Yeah.
I'm still sort of fascinated by the fact that you did it twice. You know, that's the one piece. I'm also finding interesting that people actually started picking up trash with you. And the lone Canadian. Out of curiosity, was there anybody else there picking up trash at the time, or was it just you? Like, was this a sort of a regular thing?
It was just me, but I did see some Japanese people came, and they were picking up some trash as well. I believe they were from Japan.
Okay. All right. This is Richard Land for Set for Success. We're going to be right back. We're going to talk a little bit more about Bruce's experiences with the Embrace and 40 Days in the Desert. We'll be right back. Hello and welcome back. It's Richard Lannan. You know we're tuning in for Set for Success. I've been hanging out with Bruce Benson, author of The Embrace, 40 Days in the Desert. You know, I'm still fascinated that you led, right? You decided to pick up trash in a place, a world, a country that a lot of people probably would not do that in. And yet other people started to sort of help you out, you know, along the way, which I think is always a fascinating part of the journey. I think it sort of goes to the heart of the Canadian experience. And I understand you have a bit of a Canadian story, an old Canada story for us.
Well, yeah, the old Canada story may not be exactly what you think, Richard.
Well, that's
but,
all right.
So this couldn't be a one-off, right? Like, I continue to pick trash to this day.
Okay.
If I'm walking into a store and I see some trash there, I'll pick it up. It's not always an hour a day. Or better yet, if I'm walking into a pub and then I see some trash there, I'll pick it up on the way. And if we all did that, that would make a huge difference.
Oh, our place would be so clean, right? Yeah.
But anyway, it couldn't be a one-off going to Egypt. As a matter of fact, I've booked a ticket to go to China in January 15th, but I'm not too sure what the political climate is about that. But it couldn't be a one-off. So I returned to Egypt just after the revolution, as I mentioned earlier. And now there's nobody around. All my vendor friends, because there's no tourism.
Yeah.
The revolution just happened. 1,000 people were killed in Tahrir Square like 2 months before, or a month and a half before. And no tourists are going there. So none of my vendor friends that used to sell trinkets to the tourists are there. The pyramids were deserted. Just deserted. So I'm sitting there where I started the first time, looking up. There's a nice slope up to the Sphinx. I'm looking at the right side of the Sphinx's face. And there's a gate there that there's bars there to prevent the vendors from harassing the tourists too much. And there's nobody around. And I'm thinking, I just may be the stupidest guy. Like, you called me, mentioned I could be crazy, right? To come back and there's nobody around. And I thought, well, I took off my backpack and I pulled out a garbage bag and I put on my gloves and I says, well, I'm here. I might as well go to work. And as I bent for my very first piece of trash, 2 years after I had been there before, I heard this voice from the Sphinx, a little girl. And she said, oh, Canada, you came back.
Oh, really? Right on.
And she couldn't have recognized me because she was too far away. She recognized me by what I was doing.
Mm-hmm. As the act itself. Oh,
the
Canada,
act itself. Oh,
back.
Canada, you came back. And you think about our national anthem, oh, Canada. Oh, Canada, you came back.
Yeah, we stand on guard.
I love that story.
Yeah, and you know what it is. And I think it's interesting to share it in the sense we set up as an old Canada story. Isn't that, though, pretty much the perception of the world of Canada? I mean, that's the impression that we're given inside Canada, that we are, I don't know about if the word revered is right, respected.
We're certainly perceived as peace lovers, as peacekeepers, we're certainly not known as warmongers. There is a difference between the American and the Canadian in international perception.
Yeah,
I'm convinced of that. That's why a lot of Americans travel with Canadian flags.
Yeah, it's interesting you would say that because my oldest boy is an international traveler, been all over the world and all sorts of places and great stories. And among his travels, he's traveled with Canadians, he's traveled with Americans who try to show themselves to be Canadians. And he says, but there's always an interesting thing that happens is that when you're in a country somewhere and people are talking to you, and even if an American is wearing a Canadian flag because they want to be perceived as Canadian, usually the local people know the difference. They'll say, you're Canadian, but says, you're faking it. and he has stories like that. You know, it just sort of shows up in your actions or your differences. That's what I think. I don't know if it's totally true, but that's been the story that he's shared with me.
I certainly know in my travels I've been treated well. All I bring is just my Canadianism, I guess.
Well, I get that. I get that. I want to go back to the flags of humanity. Tell us a little bit.
It's the flag of humanity. What it is.
The flag of humanity.
The flag of humanity.
Good to correct me.
And what it is two sets of hands. I gave you one here.
Yeah.
Two sets of hands in silhouette, in shadow, to represent the skin colors of people on Earth.
Yeah.
All the skin colors of people on Earth.
Okay.
And the adult hands are passing the Earth to the child. Earth Civilization Project out of Turkey, they have adopted the symbol, as well as also in the book, I wrote a universal... there's so much in it that it's difficult to do. We have such limited time.
Sure.
But flags are powerful things. You know, every nation on Earth has a flag. My goodness, I come from Gimli. The arm of Gimli has a flag. Matter of fact, the arm of Gimli flies the flag of humanity on the beach. My responsibility is to replace it when it gets tattered. But they do the replacing. I have to provide the flag. I'm hoping that at some time down the road, every nation on Earth will fly the flag. What would be the result, Richard? Ask yourself. If for three generations, children in one country could look at a flag celebrating the commonality of being human and do so knowing that children in another country, though they have a different nationality, of course, different skin color, different religion, different political structure, are, for three generations, if this happened, are looking at the same flag, celebrating that commonality of being human. I believe the return on such an investment could be massive.
Huge. Well, flags are used as symbols to bring people together, right? And they can be used as symbols to tear people apart, too.
Well, in the course of human history, millions of men and women have followed a flag or banner into battle to kill or be killed. The image of the flag being raised at Iwo Jima is a powerful, passionate image. So flags are powerful things. And as powerful flags go, I believe this one has the capacity to be the most powerful of all because it represents... all of us.
Well, that's a really great thing.
Yeah, and the people of the Earth are more than any government. We outnumber any government. We really are. And if
every nation in the world would actually fly one flag of humanity, then maybe there's an opportunity to change how generations think.
No, this flag is flown in front of the United Nations, in front of Trump Tower.
Is it?
In New York City? Oh, yeah. It's been all over the place.
So you've actually managed to put this flag in some very interesting places.
Yeah, I remember it took 5 years from my original drawing to I took it to a design team in Asheville, North Carolina. As you can tell by the original drawing in the book, I'm no artist.
Yeah, I saw.
I can catch fish, but I can't draw very well. So I took it to this design team, and it took 5 years to actually, you wouldn't think, but I wanted to get it just right. It took 5 years to do it. A lot of people contributed to it, and so now we have it. And I remember I flew it in front of the United Nations building. I was in New York City. And I'd put it up all over the place and then take pictures. And I remember the police, cops would come up to me and say, "What are you doing?" You know, very aggressively. And I would explain. And then they'd say, "Okay, well, you go right ahead," you know.
And they were good with that.
And they were good with it.
Wow.
You know, they'd say, I'd explain what I'm doing. I'd say, "Oh, okay, that's fine."
If somebody wanted to get in touch with you, how would they go about doing that?
The best is my Gmail, theflagofhumanity@gmail.com.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah. What a show we've been having. Bruce, you are a great guest.
Thanks, Richard. You're a great host.
Oh, well, thank you. I do my best. I'm curious. I think we have maybe about 15, 20 seconds or so. If you had a final thought for our listeners, what might it be?
Wow, you're putting me on the spot here. 15 seconds, quick, Bruce. It would be the embrace has in it a letter that I wrote to my son about driving that I think that if you know some young people who may be learning to drive, it'd be worth the price of the book. You can get it off Amazon.com and Bruce Benson, The Embrace, and that should...
So on the book side. All right. Learning to drive. Bruce, I want to thank you for joining us for the show for Set for Success. And you know what? I was thinking about during one of the breaks or before we started the show, we were talking about, give a man a fish, you feed him for a day. Teach a man to fish, you feed him for a lifetime. Sorry. I sort of suspect that your flag is almost like a fish. You know, you can give a man a fish and it's one thing, but you teach a man or a person to fish then with a flag, then you just connect them for a lifetime. You're a true fisherman. You know, no, true fisherman.
It's all about love, Richard.
All about love. Bruce, thanks a lot. And also for our listeners, thank you for joining us today. And if you got a question, a thought, or an idea for today's show, or round day's show, or a future show, send me an email at richard@setforsuccess.ca. And I do want you to remember something: to do your best, invest in the success of others, and make your journey count.